give you my theory on film collectors of my generation, which is admittedly most collectors. We've handled film for so long that its molecules have become fused with ours. And we've become part film. As a matter of fact, we've become movie monsters. And that's really what film collecting is. One long monster movie.
That was a clip from the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film, which features our guests today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking about a new film that celebrates film. It's a documentary about analog films and the people who've rescued them from the landfill. It's called Film is Dead, Long Live Film. And we have the director with us, Peter Flynn. Welcome
Hello.
To Words and Pictures.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by our old friend, Greg Hamilton. Greg is a film archivist and documentarian in Portland, Oregon, and he's helping bring Film is Dead, Long Live Film to the Pacific Northwest. Always a pleasure, Greg.
Always a pleasure, Conch. Thank you for having us on again.
So, Peter, you are a professor of media production and film history at Emerson College in Boston, and you've directed a number of documentaries, including The Dying of the Light, a celebration of 35mm projectionists.
Yes, I'm a bit of a one-trick pony, really. This is I have a deep interest in film history, and I don't stray too far from that subject matter. So most of my work is related to film and film history and the forgotten aspects of film history, the aspects of our history that don't end up in the textbooks.
Well, give us a little bit of an introduction to Film is Dead, Long Live Film. We're not talking about so-called digital film or digital cinema packages. We're talking about those photochemical films on cellulose acetate that have been around for over a century.
Absolutely. We're talking about analog photochemical film and the people who've devoted their lives to saving and preserving that. You know, the studios and the rights holders of these films have never been particularly good parents. They've never been good stewards. And in their minds, the film had a certain lifespan. It had a certain job to do. It had a profit to make. And once that job was completed and those earnings were pulled in, the film had no more value to the studios. So films were routinely junked, left to rot and decay. And, a very small and very passionate group of people devoted their time to pulling films out of dumpsters and saving and preserving not just the films, but the technology that to run the films, projectors, cameras, and the knowledge of handling that film, saved and preserved that for future generations because they saw value in it that the studios and copyright holders obviously didn't. And thanks to that, so much of our history and so many films survive today that would otherwise have been lost to history. So this film was an attempt to kind of acknowledge the efforts of these people and to capture something of their culture. You know, most of these people tend to be in the older age bracket. They tend to be boomers. They tend to have come of age in the post-war years. At that point when film was everywhere, right? Film was in the home in the form of 8 and 16 millimeter. It was in the school and it was in every neighborhood movie house. And that generation of people, I think, were the last real generation to fully absorb celluloid film. And now, of course, they're getting up there and that culture is going. And with that boomer culture, those boomer cinephiles, I think a great deal will be lost, a great deal of our understanding of what film was and how it was consumed and how it was embraced and loved will be lost with them. So this film is an attempt to kind of not just honor these people, but to capture some of their culture and some of that love, that old school analog cinephilia before it's gone.
I was just going to say how very excited I am to help bring Film is Dead along the film here to Portland. It really is. It's a love letter to cinema, but it is also a rallying cry for the importance of film preservation. Part of the reason why I'm bringing this film to Portland now is that I've been working on this project, working with the Dennis Nyback archive of 16 millimeter film. And it in many ways parallels some of the things that are in Film is Dead, Long Live Film, where you have large collections of films that all of a sudden no longer have an owner and are no longer spoken for. And I've been very lucky in that the Portland film community, the 16 millimeter appreciators, as it were, have banded together with me to go out and save this collection and put it into an archive that we're going to take and put back out into the community in the form of programs, much like what Dennis did when he was alive.
Talking about Dennis Nyback, that's kind of germane because he would put together collections of old Warner Brothers and Walt Disney cartoons. Bad Bugs Bunny was one of the titles of the shows he put on. And this was at the point where the studios were sanitizing their old cartoons and they didn't like audiences seeing some of those wacky, violent scenarios and the, shall we say, insensitive portrayals of ethnicity. So Dennis would get the occasional cease and desist letter from Ted Turner or from the House of Mouse, which he'd just ignore.
Yeah, no, his programs were so, there was so much variety. I remember him telling me one time, he said, "You give me a subject and I'll make a program for you." From everything from popular culture to sports to religion, it was endless. And he took those programs, like you said, all over the world. And we were just particularly blessed here in the Pacific Northwest because he lived up here for a fair amount of his career and put the shows on here in Portland and in the around surrounding area.
So, Peter, one of the hazards that comes up in the film is vinegar syndrome. And you see all this footage of films that have not been stored very well, and they have mildew, they have vinegar syndrome. And in some cases, there are very few usable frames. There's, just this one print remaining of some classic silent film, but it's really so seriously damaged. And along come the digital restorers. And a lot of artists nowadays have a problem with AI. And certainly there's art theft happening with generative AI that's really not cool. But when you have a great old film that's in the public domain and you use artificial intelligence upscaling on it, all of a sudden, you can have that film back with you again.
Right. It's very easy to cast digital as the enemy in all of this, the soulless, lifeless corporate idea of digital technology, and to contrast it negatively with the beauty, the tactile beauty and the texture of film. But digital technologies have enabled private collectors have given them the ability to scan their own prints, to digitize their own prints and restore them in some ways. So digital technologies are giving a new life to a lot of this.
Well, let's play a clip from the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film.
The complete history of film just doesn't exist. Basically, everybody threw that history away. And it's collectors like me that jumped into the bins, garbage cans, started collecting stuff. And then when people started saying, "Hey, what happened to this film?" somebody in the woodwork had it.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking about Film is Dead, Long Live Film. This is a documentary about preserving the analog photochemical films that played in cinemas for well over a century before digital came along. We're joined today by director Peter Flynn, as well as film archivist Greg Hamilton. Peter, one of the heroes of your film is Rick Prellinger of the Internet Archive. And Rick is one of those folks who's been around a very long time. In fact, before the Internet Archive, there was the Prellinger Archive, and it was
Right.
all analog material. I can remember that from when I was in film school. Without getting too off topic, archive.org is getting a lot of attention at the moment for preserving public data while the new regime
Right.
in Washington tries to scrub government websites of information they don't like.
Yeah. Rick is a great case in point here because, you know, we have the Library of Congress, we have the National Archives, and they save and preserve a certain type of film, the big films. One of the great values of private film collectors is that they tend to be focused on very specific genres or very specific eras or types of films. And Preilinger, of course, is focused primarily on home movies. And who's saving and preserving home movies? Very few people. He spearheaded a contemporary interest in home movies that, you know, I don't know if it would exist without Preilinger's efforts to put them out there and make people aware of them. So that was a whole genre of filmmaking and a whole history of film, over 100 years of amateur filmmaking that would be completely forgotten if it weren't for the efforts of people like Rick Preilinger to save and preserve films that we just don't think of as film. When we think of film, we think of 35 millimeter studio release pictures. We think of theatrical films. We don't think of all these other parts of film history. And as a result, they tend to get forgotten and lost and fall between the cracks. So collectors with their own idiosyncratic focuses prove a blessing in saving and preserving the lesser known material. And Preilinger is a shining case in point, I think.
Hey, Peter, let me ask you a question about your film.
Yeah.
In the process of making it, I mean, was there a moment in there that you really felt that the film came together, that it crystallized, that there was something that, you know, the story was going to be manifest in this particular place?
There were definitely moments where I thought, oh, wow, now I can begin to see the film. But the roadmap was fairly clear to me from the get-go, because the first shooting I did with a film collector called Lou De Crescenzo. And Lou was at that stage in his life where he'd spent 50 years collecting films and film projectors, and he was now too unwell to really take care of it. So he was passing it on. And he realized that he needed to pass on the films, the projectors and the equipment, the love of it, to help generate an excitement for an audience. So like yourself, he was showing these films at movie theaters, putting together his own programs, bringing the projector out into the audience. And also he realized he needed to pass on the knowledge of how to handle and project this film. So he was training somebody to take over. And that, to me, very early on defined what this film was about. It was about the need to pass this on. And in doing so, when passing all this stuff on, you pass something of yourself on, and you become, in a way, you know, immortal. You live on, you defy death. And Lou always said, you know, you'll end your film with a dedication to me. And I would laugh it off. And he was right. I did, because he passed away just as I was putting the final touches to the film. So he gave the film its structure and he gave the film its themes. And thanks to him, I knew exactly where I needed to go with the film. But then there was, you know, there was little moments. Like, for instance, I remember interviewing a collector, Ray Fayola. And we're sitting in a screening room and he's talking about 16 and his favorite film prints and all of this stuff, which is fascinating to me. And then he says, do you mind if let me bring my wife in? You can interview her. And I thought, well, OK, if you want, Ray, I really want to hear about your King Kong print, but OK. And in comes Ray's wife, Ariella. And she completely blows me away. And she's so passionate and so articulate. And she introduced this element that I hadn't fully latched onto in the beginning. And that is the impact that a collector has on their immediate circle, their family members and their children. And it's not always a positive one. It can be very difficult to live with. Just that difficulties of managing a social life and a marriage and all the obligations when you have this mountainous collection to tend to as well. And so Ray and Ariella opened up the scope of the film, and I realize now I have to talk to the children and the partners of collectors as well to get a sense of what that impact is. And that gave the film a lot more heart and a lot more honesty too. I mean, there's a dark side to collecting. There can be a dark side to collecting. It wreaks a lot of damage and a lot of havoc on people's lives and their health. The collections can take over. And that, you know, became a part of the film. But I think ultimately what came through was a great sense of love and admiration for people who themselves have a great deal of love and admiration for something.
Well, there are some moments of suspense in the film, in Film is Dead, Long Live Film, where the collectors are going into leaky garages where all these films have been kept for years.
Yeah. There's a lot of adventure and peril in this hobby. I think the natural evolution of a film collector is they encounter it in that primal moment in their childhood. They encounter it in the classroom, or they encounter it at home with an 8mm Laurel and Hardy on the wall, and boom, they're hooked. So they go to their local camera store and they pick up Black Hawk and Castle Films, which were the dominant companies for producing at-home movies. And then they grow out of that and they want the forbidden fruit. And the forbidden fruit is 16mm television prints. So how do you get 16mm television prints? Well, you bribe somebody at the local TV station and they meet you at the back door and you walk off with an episode of Hogan's Heroes or I Love Lucy or whatever it is. And then that forbidden fruit leads to more forbidden fruit. And next thing you know, you're outside the law, right? For many, it moves on to 35mm film collecting. And that's when you really enter into the outlaw territory. You know, now you're bribing a projectionist to, you know, look the other way while you walk out of a theater with a, you know, Bugs Bunny cartoon. Or you're going to the film depot and bribing somebody there and you're taking out prints that you have no right to possess and own. And then you're, you know, the local movie house closes down and you have a crowbar and you're opening the back door and you're climbing through and you're with a flashlight climbing your way up to the projection booth and picking out whatever you have there. So it kind of grows and expands.
Yeah, Peter, you have all of these collectors who are kind of heroes while being outlaws at the same time. You mentioned Louis DiCrescenzo. Also, Ira Gallen is in there, Skip Elsheimer, Jack Theakston. Yeah, they've
Bob
all...
Bob Firmenich, yeah.
They've all sort of had their brushes with the big copyright holders.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And in the case of Bob Firmenich and Jack Theakston of the 3D Film Archive, a lot of their efforts is in tracking down and securing permission and rights permission and dealing with a film that is locked away in a vault or whose copyright status is very murky. And there's a lot of those titles that, well, who owns this? Well, the paperwork goes back 40 years and it's not quite so clear cut. Frequently, what you'll find is that people will boil from releasing it out of fear of any public lawsuit down the line. And sometimes it takes a leap of faith. There's an immense, you know, for a hobby that is fundamentally embedded in love and passion, there's tremendous amount of hostility in this hobby. The collectors hate the studios. The studios hate the collectors. The studios and the collectors hate the archives. The archives hate everybody. And so there's all this kind of infighting, and certain collectors don't like other collectors, and I'll go to my death and I'll destroy this print before anybody else gets their hands on it. There was a lot of that. Most of all of that infighting, I think, has kind of gone away now. And there's a great and I think increasingly healthy relationship between collectors and studios and the archives. But that wasn't always the case. There was that point when the studios were actively pursuing collectors, you know, and were using the FBI to hunt down and imprison and fine collectors. And it was quite a strange and frightening period for collectors.
You speak to that in your film.
Yeah, tell us about Captain Celluloid and the film pirates.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And that's a film that was made in the mid-1960s. Made primarily by film collectors about the hazards and the thrills of film collecting. And it's about an organization that illegally acquires prints and dupes them and sells them, and which a lot of collectors were doing. And maybe not collectors, but a lot of, say, enterprising individuals realized that money could be made from absconding with a print of, it was running in a movie theater, and then making 16 millimeter dupes of it and selling those. So that was a kind of a roaring trade back at that time. So these collectors made a short film about this and this superhero type character named Captain Celluloid, whose job it was to hunt down these nefarious film pirates. And it's a great kind of time capsule look at film collecting in that, mid-century America. It's wonderful. And it also just kind of taps into the growing hostilities between these institutions and collectors that would then explode in the 1970s when the FBI actively began to hunt down collectors. People like Roddy McDowell had their collection seized. McDowell had prints of Planet of the Apes and How Green Was My Valley seized.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who were referred to as eccentric collectors, but some of those eccentric collectors were celebrities like Roddy McDowell and Hugh Hefner.
Yes, absolutely. There's a fascinating history. It isn't just the films and the film history that makes the hobby of film collecting fascinating and interesting. There's the history of film collecting itself and the various generations of film collectors that to me is just a great, great story. So I was very happy in my own kind of small, underfunded way to tell something of that story and hopefully carry that torch on to a new generation.
Let's play another clip from the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film.
In the beginning, as they say, there was just film. And then there were film collectors, and pretty soon there were film pirates to feed the film collectors. It's almost impossible to protect a film against pirates.
I've been offered films. A lot of things get thrown away in the trash cans, and hey, there's not a trash can out there around town that doesn't have a film collector lurking under it.
Piracy, as it is now and as it could be in the future, is a cancer in the belly of the film business.
They were concerned that we were making videotapes. They don't understand film collectors. Film collectors hate videotapes. VHS tapes were the worst. A true film collector wants film. They don't want tape.
I could give you a list this high of the busts that have been made by the FBI, prosecutions by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And for the first time in the last 6 months or so, and increasingly in the years ahead, they're going to jail.
They knocked on the door. They said they had a warrant to search the garage. They never did come in the house. They checked the garage and a storage unit we had that our landlady was kind enough to give them information about. But yeah, it was scary. We were all supposed to get 6 months suspended sentences. And, I went down to court that day. I didn't even say goodbye to my wife because I was coming home. And the judge said 6 months and didn't say suspended afterwards. And they hauled me off in handcuffs, which was a surprise.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking about Film is Dead, Long Live Film. This is a documentary about preserving the analog photochemical films that played in cinemas for well over a century before digital came along. We're joined today by director Peter Flynn, as well as film archivist Greg Hamilton. I don't know that there's a villain in this film, in Film is Dead, Long Live Film, but the name Jack Valenti does come up. And and this is a guy who worked for Lyndon Johnson before becoming a lobbyist. He was the longtime head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, where he helped create the rating system for movies. In 1998, Valenti lobbied for the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. For me, I'm against anything that restricts the free flowing of films, anything that locks a film away, that keeps it from an audience, that keeps it from being viewed, is to me the enemy. And whatever we can do, legally or not, to ensure that these films continue to circulate and flow and live, I'm all for. Maybe a very simplistic and maybe a very naive view of the situation, but I think that's what's important here, that these films continue to circulate. And any effort to prevent that needs to be opposed.
Peter, you talked to a fellow in the film named George Willeman, and he's the head of the, I believe, the Library of Congress's Nitrate Film Collection?
The Nitrate Film Collection Manager, yes, George. And George has a great affinity with film collectors, and he's just a wonderful, personable man. You know, when we talk about the relationships between collectors and studios and the archives thawing in recent years, it's thanks to people like George Willeman, who really maintain a very close and personable relationship with collectors. For years, a collector did not want to deal with an archive because they felt it'll go into an archive. The archive will inform that it came from me. They'll inform the studio that it came from me, and I'll get into trouble with that. That has since changed because, you know, the studios now realize that they can put an extra feature on their Blu-ray release of Gone with the Wind or whatever that came from a collector. So the hostilities have ceased. And in my experience, I can't think of an archive that has a more congenial relationship with collectors than the Library of Congress. And that is largely because of people like George Willeman. And the Library of Congress has a great policy. If you have a nitrate print, they will send you the shipping details. They will have it shipped from your home to their archives as, you know, special hazardous material. And they pay for all of that. They make it very easy on you. They want that stuff in their archives and not in your basement. Oh, hi, wow. George, if you're listening.
Yes, yes.
Now, let me take issue with one thing you said to me.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Oh, you absolutely,
said my film does not have a villain. And I disagree. I think it does. And it has the greatest villain and the ultimate villain, death. The film is about death and the fight against death, right? Film dies and decays. We die and decay. And with death, we get forgotten. And everybody we knew and every thought we had in our head gets lost. And the wonderful thing about film was, of course, that it held on to things that were meant to die and be forgotten. And collectors have played their part in ensuring that aspects of our culture and the people within it have not died and have not been forgotten, that they continue on in some form or another. I think film does that more effectively than any other medium, in my opinion. And the efforts to preserve and hold on to that is, in a sense, you know, the greatest human struggle, isn't it? To say that we will not die, we will not be forgotten, we will not go gently into that good night. So that is the villain of the film, and that struggle is to overcome it in some small way. Until, of course, the asteroid hits us and we're all, you know, oblivion. But until that moment, we'll have film.
Well, on that note, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today about the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film. Our guests have been director Peter Flynn and film archivist Greg Hamilton. Peter and Greg, great to have you on the show.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us back. Can I tell your listeners about one other thing before we go?
Please do.
For those of you who love documentaries, obviously, if you're listening now, you love documentaries. On March 4th, I'm going to be bringing a couple of documentaries done by the filmmaker Les Blank in celebration of Mardi Gras over at the Clinton Street Theater on March 4th at 7 p.m. So that, and also remember that March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, we'll be showing Film is Dead, Long Live Film. The screening is going to be over at the Clinton Street Theater. We'll be doing that at 7 o'clock. But I'm just really excited for people to not only to see your film, but also just to grasp the fact that they have something like this going on in their own backyard.
And Greg, I understand that there's a new website for the NIBAC Film Archive.
Indeed. Thank you for reminding me. For those that are interested, check out NIBACarchive.org. That's NIBACarchive.org.
Peter, for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about Film is Dead, Long Live Film, where would they look?
You can visit my website at coldeyefilms.com, coldeyefilms. Yes, I can spell it, coldeyefilms.com. And we will be releasing the film on Blu-ray shortly as a double disc set with The Dying of the Light, my documentary on the history and demise of analog film projection. So keep an eye out for that. And if you visit my website, you'll see information on that upcoming release.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media. at Words and Picture.